And all right, we're gonna get ready here shortly. This is the Out of the Woods Guess Who Adversary Edition. So this would be kind of a fun thing. We've done this once before. We made some changes, so it'll be a little different of flow, but hoping that it'll help with some of the conversation as well. So for those that aren't familiar with the live edition of our Out of the Woods, we have a Discord that you can join, and you can join in the conversation. A great place to make comments, ask questions, engage however you'd like. We love all that, and we try to keep an eye on it as well. So we'll be kind of ping-ponging back and forth. I'm your host, Scott Poley. I'm a senior or principal threat hunter at Intel 471. I'm joined by Tom. You want to introduce yourself, buddy?
Yeah, hello everybody. The trusty sidekick to Scott here. I am also a threat hunter here at Intel 471. We're both, I think I'm speaking for you a little bit here, Scott. We're both passionate practitioners in the security field and very strong defender advocates. And we really love talking shop. So these shows are great for us because we like diving into some of these things and we love engaging with everybody. So anyone that's in the Discord, anybody that's following along, please chime in, correct us if you catch some flaws, and just contribute to the conversation. We want to hear from you.
Absolutely. So, the biggest goal here for those that maybe are stumbled across this, there is a ways to win things with this one, because we're going to cover an adversary and we're going to talk through some of their behaviors, their techniques. But we're also going to pivot to some threat hunting ideas around it. And you can submit, you'll see, we'll provide the link in a bit, but you can submit your answer, but you only can submit. We only count your first answer, and we understand threat actors have aliases. We're trying to account for that too. But yeah, so the idea is to listen in. You can be doing some research based on things we say to try to come up with your answers, whatever you want to do. But it's supposed to be kind of a fun. How well do you know this adversary? Does it sound familiar? And yeah, feel free to join in as much as you want as well. But try not to throw anything that would be answer specific in Discord, because we want everyone to kind of have the same challenge. So these are the basic rules and breakout here. So, like I said, one guess. There'll be a submission link. They'll be put in Discord shortly. Only the first 10 people that get it right will actually receive the T-shirt, which is the reward this time. And then once everything ends and the threat actor is revealed, that's when submissions will close. But we'll have a little timer going at the end to kind of give people some time to make some last minute guesses. And yeah, so make sure you provide information so we can send your reward on the submission form, and I guess we'll kind of kick it off. So, Tom, I really enjoyed this. We'll probably talk to that a little bit, but we really this Guess Who edition, we focus on a nation state adversary, so that's kind of the first hint here. Last time, what we did ransomware, is that right, Tom? A ransomware
Yeah,
actor?
we did a ransomware group. Yep.
Yeah, so the big thing here is, when we talk through some of the behaviors, you got to kind of keep in mind, what does nation state really mean? And there's a lot to be said as far as how to, I guess, defend differently, especially when you compare them to something like a ransomware actor. They usually are really well funded. Typically, impact is, I say, different. Now we've seen where now nation states, when it comes to conflicts and wars, they kind of have that destructive approach like you would see from ransomware groups. But realistically, it's really about how to collect information. Like inf you look at nations, knowledge is power in a lot of ways. So how they operate, get in, what they actually gather, what kind of hooks they use, it all kind of makes sense based on their overall motives. So through this, we'll kind of be ping-ponging, using that term too much, obviously, back and forth as far as why this is so a unique thing or unique behavior and how it's tied to potentially nation state stuff as well. Tom, anything you want to add to the nation state perspective here?
No, and we've been kind of in this field, and we've gone through a lot of different exercises IR incidents and things like that across many different groups and vectors. And we've always considered nation state stuff, right, Scott, in different areas and different focuses. But one of the things that I, one of the first points I found interesting, especially when diving in and really researching a little more in depth for this show, was the, it seems to me, and I'm wondering if you had the same feeling, that some of the nation state stuff tends to fly under the radar relative to a lot of the stuff that's catching headlines, the ransomware groups, the ransomware as a service attacks, those high, those high profile targets that get hit by those things. Especially, at least to me, when I kind of look back through our data and a lot of the stuff that we've talked about, even on our shows, the nation state stuff tends to fly under the radar a little bit. That was an interesting analysis from my side. I'm curious if you've seen the same thing.
Yeah, I feel like a lot of that attributes to the impact. Like you, if you look at how news media outlets usually report things, I think it's similar to how reporting in general works. If there is like fear or scare or alarming, anything to it, seems to get more of the headlines. Where if a nation state were to get in somewhere, if it was like a really unique target or something like that, sometimes you get those kind of reports. And obviously, you subscribe to like some of the big threat intel firms and things that deal with instant response, you'll see reports. But yeah, it's not a like a big capturing thing, right? Because it's the impact's slightly different, and it's kind of just more of a crafty thing.
Yeah, but I think as we'll reveal in
Oh
this
yeah.
episode, there's a lot there that lives and that it's reused and leveraged in different ways. So it reminded me to make sure that I'm paying attention to some of the, the well-documented, well-detailed, sophisticated groups, especially from the nation state side, even if there isn't maximum impact, because the long-lasting effects that their efforts have are, they're scary at times, like even if they're not highlighted in a highlight or a newsreel, right?
Yeah, and sometimes the impact is kind of goes unseen because it's more having the capability for impact in a lot of cases, right? So positioning. Hopefully we never see the impact where these types of actors can be sitting and waiting. And the other thing to kind of add some context for how we did some of our research is I actually kind of started as far back historically as I could. And kind of walked towards the present. And Tom, you kind of took a different approach, right? You started more recent.
Yeah, I tried to stay and look to see what was more recent, which was really kind of eye-opening because there was things that kind of flew under my radar a little bit. I was a little mad at myself about not catching some of them. But yeah, so we're kind of coming at this from two different sides, and not it probably won't track that way through every topic we discuss, but a lot of them are going to be there. So it's going to be interesting to compare and contrast what we talk about and like the evolution of this actor, things they still use, things they've held on to and adapted, things they've used once and thrown away, et cetera.
Yeah, and it'd be cool if people are listening and they want to contribute. One of the things that would be a fun highlight in the Discord chat is if some of the things we mentioned you're at least aware of or have seen before. I think that adds some gravity to some of the things we may be saying as well. So feel free to share that from your own personal experiences. So with that, let's dive in to kind of the first part. So reconnaissance, Tom, I'll let you kind of run with this a little bit as far as some of the things you want to touch on. All these slides, by the way, we're just kind of having them up here so that one, it kind of cues us for things that to talk on, but also gives you guys a way to kind of group some of the information that we might hit on. So it's not going to be 100% inclusive of everything we say just as a reference. So Tom, go ahead. Why don't you kick that part
Yeah,
off?
so kicking, because this is one I'd like to toss to you, because I'm kind of curious where your mindset is here. But when we think about reconnaissance, it tends to, and at least from my experience, it tends to be kind of a, we really look at that as an afterthought, right? We're looking for the next piece of the behavior, things we can track, the stuff that's more has more validity and telemetry, right? But this specific adversary, like they are very heavy in the enumeration side, scanning efforts across public the public infrastructure of the specific target. They are, when they look for a target, they go heavy, they go hard. Their attempts for that recon also include the, routinely registering very highly detailed lookalike domains relative to what they're trying to target. I'm going to try to not give stuff away because I remember we were talking before the show that our notes have so much. We want to not give it away too early. But the effort that this group goes to gather contextual intelligence before kind of building these tailored intrusion campaigns are top of class. The stuff that we see time over time, the longevity of this approach was one of the things that was really noticeable. And understanding, it's been many years that they've been around and they take these similar approaches from this particular category on the recon side. It's really less talking about more of the specifics because recon, and this is one I'd like to toss to you, Scott, after you kind of go through your bullet points here. But I generally am curious what your thoughts are on from like a hunting perspective or maybe even a defense perspective. What are kind of your top targets for considering anything in the recon category that you might want to track, look for, or potentially alert on, or protect yourself from?
Yeah, so a lot of the things I was seeing, and I think what makes sense from like even a defensive posture. So this group was, when we talk recon, I'd almost put it in like the section of research, right? They were like really well informed as far as what big solution firms or third party contractors worked between targets. So they looked at all those like avenues that may not be direct to their potential target. They're really big about how they hammered and understood government, and then also how that government influenced different areas based on their target sets. And they did spend a lot of ties about media and news specific lures. In some cases, even going after journalists and things as well from some of their targeting perspective. And it's probably because they do deal a lot in, information and misinformation in a lot of ways. And, what's interesting about that is it's not just, hey, we have systems that are on the edge and that's what we're going to be looking at and that's what may be getting profiled. It's almost if you were to do research on yourself, like your company, what their dealings are, what specific things are in the news, like kind of having your, ear to the ground on those things could kind of help you predict different ways they might come at you from a phishing capacity because they obviously have leveraged phishing extensively for a lot of their really early campaigns, especially. But they use tons of typo squatting on a lot of popular or affiliated sites. So, we've talked about a DNS twister in the past, but there's a lot of things you could do if you can understand that footprint. That's something that I thought was an interesting thing. And then also, when it comes to recon and stuff internally, what was interesting was, we're kind of in the period of lull bins, right? And you've probably seen some of it, but they do some more lull bin stuff more recently. But historically, we're going back like 2008, 2009. They made a lot of custom malware. And a lot of the custom malware's capabilities was grabbing a lot of the same things that people leverage for lull bins. I don't know if they rely as heavily on custom malware as much anymore. They still have a lot of their strains they're constantly updating and modifying. But yeah, I mean, they're looking at how your internal network layouts look, what kind of processes are there. And it's more to kind of figure out how to then carry the attack even further, get their hooks in more places, avoid detection. So that's what a lot of the recon seems to go towards in a lot of ways, that I was able to pull from a lot of sources, which really shows the that persistence perspective, right? Like they want to be present, they want to be there, and they want to stay there, which I think is, kind of is what people used to worry about in the past. I think, that whole mantra, right? Like defend like you've already been pwned perspective originated from the APT persona, right? Like, if ransomware is there, you only have so much time before it's going to be pretty obvious. And so people, like a newer generation of security professionals, are kind of dealing with more of that, like, being ready to react versus, dealing like you've already been compromised. So that was like the big key thing for me when it came to the reconnaissance side. I don't know if that completely lined up with everything you had going on.
Well, there's an interesting add-on, and this could I guess can be considered taken as a clue. I assume everything we're talking about is a clue, but traditionally you'd see, and you've kind of mentioned like the government kind of focus or the different targets. Basically you're looking at nation states, so they're going to be aligned generally with their initiatives, right? With some of the more recent activity was actually very interesting to me when I kind of put it all together, where the consideration for variant factors within our current times. So looking to try to achieve certain goals where you would leverage or might target, like the technology or logistics sector. You might consider an approach that, in the same light of what we talked about with the heavy emphasis on their initial contextual intelligence gathering and the things that they're trying to target, and considering that the world is in more of a state of a work from home remote kind of posture, and they'd adjust their targets accordingly, which was really, in my brain, it's really cool to look at because it's super cool in that field of like the sophistication there, but also very scary considering the efforts that could be put to something like that, right?
Absolutely.
And that's me trying to talk around, not giving out too much from my notes here.
Right. Yeah, we'll finally give up more and more as we step through, just so we just don't want to give up
Yeah.
just too early, right? But
Too
yeah,
early. Yeah.
the reconnaissance piece is, just important because it really shows the targeting, right? I think that's the biggest highlight is, who they impersonate, what they do. There's been heavy use of phishing for credential gathering. There's been heavy use of phishing with attachments to help deploy malware. I mean, that's, kind of common across the board. And their stuff's changed, but we'll get into some of those initial access pieces, which I think is pretty cool. So if you're ready to pivot, Tom, we can go ahead and pivot to the next.
Yeah, let's do it.
Because, all right. So that goes into some initial access stuff. And this is where it starts getting interesting for me as well. All right. So,
You go ahead and kick this one off, Scott.
all right. I'll kick this one off. So there were a few things that I thought were really interesting. Like we talked about some of the, reconnaissance aspects, and there's some just the traditional phishing that goes along with that. And because they do a lot of custom malware, that becomes you saw definitely a lot of that in the earlier days. They get their malware delivered, and they're using things like macros on Excel documents and all the things that have, there's been some controls in place, and people have been getting better at handling. But there were some techniques that I thought were incredibly interesting, and I was curious, Tom. I one of the techniques they used, tab nabbing. Have you heard of that?
I don't think I have. Can you give me that definition? I might know it as something
Yes.
else, but I
Well,
just know that word.
yeah, I feel like I was part of a conversation or listening to something when it was talked about, but it kind of went over my head, or I didn't pick up on like what it really was. It's actually a really ingenious attack, and I think it's meant to target me specifically, because the idea is, you get a like a phishing email, right? And I don't know if this is a feature or a vulnerability in browsers, or if it's something that is controlled anymore now from when it occurred, but it's basically like taking over adjacent tabs you may have open. And so here's like the attack path. You get a phishing email and it's like, oh, something you may be interested in. And it's a link that goes to a site that will be like an event or be something that seems, basically non-malicious. And what it really is it takes you to a site that loads the non-malicious site in. So you're seeing a legitimate site, but there's JavaScript that runs. And what that does is it takes the tab you came from. For instance, like if you're using webmail and say you're on your webmail tab, it will change that tab to look like a login as if your webmail timed out. And but you'll be on their infrastructure. So you're like, oh, I gotta log back into my webmail because it timed out as you switch back the tabs, like that stale tab thing from things you leave open and stuff like that. That's what it takes advantage of. So it's so indirect, right? Where you there's legit, all it is to run a simple JavaScript that makes other tabs you were in or on go to this malicious login that looks legitimate. So you just throw in your credentials thinking, oh yeah, it's normal, it timed out, let me get back in. I thought it was ingenious. But now, like every single time I'm gonna see a login page, I'm gonna have to really pay attention to the URL or maybe just reload.
Man,
So.
that's interesting, Scott, because that forever, because of the way environments we both worked in, and we understand, like, that's common, right? That kind of logout time, whatever,
Absolutely.
your stuff, you're leaving your work there, you're leveraging tabs, you're grouping tabs, you're doing all this stuff, man. That's man, and now I gotta look, because yeah, it's just become you become so it becomes habitual to
Yeah.
just relog in, right? You just want to get back to work. That's crazy. It's pretty cool.
So yeah, that was a really cool technique that they leveraged. The other one I've heard of, but I was able to dig a little deeper in, and that's OAuth, right? So open authentication is people are probably familiar with it, but basically it's the mindset that you can use your Gmail or your Facebook or whatever to log into all these services, right? So you can have like the same consistent account that gives you access to things, simplifies things, so you don't have multiple usernames and passwords. So there's a convenience factor, right? So one of the things that they did was some of these providers, I forgot what the subscribers or whatever it's called, to create a service essentially, that you can use OpenAuth for. They would create like an application or something, get it approved, right, to the people that sign off on the OpenAuth stuff, and then they would start sending phishing emails to their targets to trick them into basically registering with their service, right? And by doing that, now there's that OpenAuth connection, which creates a token, which basically is a valid token of like credentials that now they have for that OpenAuth that they can then leverage and use for anything else that uses OpenAuth for those types of services. So it's a way to kind of steal credentials. But the unique thing is if you were to change your credentials or do something, until you invalidate that token, it still works. So it's like a way for you to indirectly harvest. The only thing you really have to do is get them to subscribe to your service with OpenAuth. So that's the trickery, is how do you create a phishing email so they click to the links and they like log in to try to do whatever it is to their service, which they passed off as a legitimate service anyways. Yeah, a lot of setting up some infrastructures, a lot of thought going into that, but a lot of capability, especially with how a lot of people probably use OpenAuth. I'm one of those people that I typically just like having my own username and password for a lot of reasons. And I use the extended email a lot of times for my username, where I use the plus sign and then put some destinations so I can see how my information is being harvested. But another topic for another day, but that was one of their techniques, which I thought was really cool for that initial access, right? And then, historically, I mean, since they go back, 2007, 2008, watering hole with exploit kits, that's, the exploit kits were kind of a thing, in the early days, right? Where basically you would land on the site, it would determine what kind of browser or system you're running, it would do some maybe redirection or things, and basically exploits you and you wouldn't even know, So that's a classic thing. I think they kind of still exist. It's just not as much anymore because web browser security has definitely gotten better. But they still use watering hole techniques. And we'll talk a little bit about that when it comes to the credential access. But I have seen where they've taken compromised sites. It's like big sites, news sites. We talked about news sites before. I've seen where the target was around energy and they compromised sites that were like blogs and specific sites for engineering and stuff like that. And the compromise for in that aspect wasn't so much the initial access, as credential harvest, getting the NTLM creds. And we'll talk to that a little later. But basically, they would put things on the site that would force you to connect to their SMB share, which naturally Windows would then share off NTLM creds to try to pull down whatever that is. So I'll talk to a little later. 0 days. I mean, that's the one thing that I think is really unique with nation states in a lot of ways, is not that they use 0 days, but the volume of 0 days they can use. So like in I think 2015, they used like 5 or 6 0 days, which is pretty quick and kind of a quick burn and turn capability. Because a lot of times you have, I had conversations, even, talking with government entities, like, well, if you have 0 days, like, when do you use them? If you sit on them too long, they eventually go away. So I always wonder, like, was there a critical reason why they wanted to burn them? They know they're going to get, patched or fixed, like that kind of discussion. But they use 0 days much quicker than your average adversary. And then another and the interesting initial access piece that they leveraged was SNMP. SNMP is a network management protocol, and they were able to see where the community strings, which is kind of like the password, I would say, for SNMP, was either weak or the default setting. And they're able to leverage SNMP to profile and interact with edge devices and then later pivot to internal things to get information about a network or target network. And I believe they took advantage of a vulnerability that allowed them to actually install things on said devices, which is pr pretty key for some of their big operations that became a big news item from that perspective. But yeah, so like a lot of really interesting initial access pieces. And I think one of the reasons why maybe the nation state kind of takes really interesting approaches for initial access, there's probably a good chance they're less detectable. Right. And because if we're always looking for the traditional sense of things, then there's maybe a chance for us to stumble across it versus now we have to like kind of follow the rabbit hole a different way. So there's that, but also sometimes their targets might be really tough targets to break into. So the creativity comes out, right? You talk about attacking government entities or things, and it's funny, we can have a whole laugh track on where government entities maybe fail, right? For just the normal common things. But they usually have a budget that helps them put up some pretty good defenses and walls. And so yeah. So that was my big blurb on some of the initial access. So yeah, I didn't know how many of those things that you saw from recent activities, Tom, but th those took me up to about, 2015 to 2020, roughly. So.
Yeah, it's interesting, the tab nabbing. I dropped a question in the chat here just to see if anyone else has heard it, because it was relatively new to me and you. And we have kind of a mix. People were aware that it was common, and others that it was brand new, which is interesting, because I almost feel like I just completely missed something, because I never heard that, man. So it's pretty cool. The OAuth thing was interesting. Go ahead.
I was just gonna say, it's like a buzzword that didn't stick. Like I feel like if it became a big buzzword, everybody would know because that's how it works in security. But yeah, so.
I'm sure it's crossed our faces in intel stuff that we've ingested, right? Like that we've read or absorbed. But yeah, no, that's something that I got to make sure I keep top of mind because of the just because of how we generally work. I mean, I think a lot of people work that way. The OAuth thing is interesting too, especially as just a little drop note. Like this adversary absolutely looks to target kind of the mobile side of the world too. So they go after mobile devices, mobile applications as well. And something that, from the OAuth side, a lot of people, I don't think, fully understand that they're allowing that OAuth authorization when they leverage certain applications or certain things on their mobile devices. This is something that historically I've caught in the past where, you download an app on your phone, you're doing X, Y, and Z to accomplish a thing, and you're not really reading the fine print, and you're allowing this OAuth authorization, which could give quite a bit of control with that token over your access to things. And I've tracked that, seen that, had to shut some of that down before because the end user just didn't realize what kind of door they opened with that. So just a little tidbit from that point. I won't beat on every bullet I kind of have here, because we kind of talked about it. It's just the depth and the variety that this group really does go to cannot, we won't understate it. We're probably going to overstate it, with what they how they try to accomplish leveraging against their targets. So I'll just kind of talk about one thing that I add here, because I'd like to try where we have the room to drop a little bit of hunting kind of nuggets, right? Because it is a threat hunting podcast, right? So one of the and then this is just one of many. So they're one of their bread and butter is kind of attacking those 0 days, like you talked about, looking for those vulnerabilities, doing that public facing application scanning, kind of like trying to find those, where are all the doors, profiling all the doors that they can possibly get into their given target. This CVE 2023 23397. So this one was a this was you know back I think near the end of 2023 if I remember right, but it was a vulnerability in Windows, the Windows version of Microsoft Outlook that allowed attackers to send specifically crafted emails, which would then trigger a connection from the victim's machine to that remote SMB share, kind of without any user interaction. And then when Outlook would reaches out to that attacker-controlled server via SMB, the victim's NTLM v2 hash would then be leaked, which the attacker could then, like, relay crack, leverage for access. But this one was interesting too, because I think it's an easy hunting consideration, right? So this is something that we've profiled before from our side of the house. Really, it's general in the idea of what you're trying to look for. I think telemetry tends to be pretty prominent for this, so it's one you can kind of go after. But really looking for like the system or the NTSO kernel.exe processes initiating traffic to like your non-internal IP spaces kind of over those SMB ports. So, 445, 389, et cetera. Pretty simple kind of thought for a hunt that is looking to track that activity for a vulnerability that has been heavily leveraged. And even though this was back in 2023, and there have been patches to help mitigate this thing, it is absolutely still being leveraged. So something to consider. But yeah, from my side, I think that one was just a good evident example of some of the variety relative to, comparing what you had.
Yeah, I would say like one of the things that hopefully will stand out, there are going to be some common things that from past to present, they kind of still lean on the same capabilities. And there's some things that change, which naturally I think is interesting. When you talk about an adversary that's been around for like, 20 plus years, we were talking offline about this. You got a group of trained individuals, but if you're working for like a government entity and things like that, like people will phase out and phase in. So it's not really the same people. And I think why they can still hold the same group name is they have like the same mission and maybe same SOPs, but there are going to be things that change just because people change. And obviously capabilities and technology around them change in the world too. But when we talk behaviors, that's what changes behaviors the most, is just different people. So
Yep. An additional
nice.
note before we pass the initial access, one thing that we haven't yet touched on, but I'm kind of like dropping little breadcrumbs through the clues. One thing that was part of an initial access, especially in more recent years, in the more recent time frame, last 24 months, is an emphasis on looking for edge device access. So just a little nugget to drop there relative
Oh
to the
yeah,
new environment. But
they definitely leverage edge device stuff, which is crazy.
Where are we going next, Scott? Are we on execution now?
Yeah, we're on execution.
Okay.
So,
I'm gonna kick this one off. That's cool.
yeah.
So I really looking at execution. I took I'm going at the low hanging fruit. I'm gonna let Scott kind of go after some of the more in the weeds, because I think some of the points he has are a little bit cooler than some of the stuff that I'm on. But this is one that we kind of had talked about many times. So I'm completely okay kind of reemphasizing it, because I think it's one of those behaviors that is just kind of a general, it should be a shoe-in, right? You should, these are things you should be looking for relative to a lot of threats, because it's a commonly leveraged behavior. But when you think in execution, you're looking at kind of that command and scripting interpreter bucket, which can be a handful of things. But in this particular case, one very distinct a behavior that is leveraged through the years, this is one that has been carried over quite a bit, is leveraging PowerShell to like a hidden PowerShell window to connect to the internet to pull, execute, upload, download payloads. Is the it, for any of that's actually seeing the screen watching, your basic PowerShell commands that contain that exact bypass, the IEX flags, the hidden flags. There's a lot of easy stuff in there. The new object. Net.web client, that's another giveaway. These are ones that, again, we've talked about quite a bit, but this is one from this specific adversary that is still being leveraged even into this year. It is a mainstay in some of their tactics of kind of getting to that foothold, executing their payloads and et cetera. So that's just a quick one that I have, Scott. I have a couple more notes, but I'd like to hear what you have and dive in on yours.
Yeah, so the only thing that's really fascinating to me is like obviously starting historically, there was a lot of custom malware, right? And so the custom malware, they, based on the execution, was based on having the multi-stages of malware where they had downloaders, which then did this, and they usually pivoted off maybe an exploit or a macro. So like that traditional path of executions, they get their malware running. But the one thing that some interesting things I kind of pulled out was, you know, and it kind of took me back to my early security days. I mean, you talked about like execution, and, you know, I really focused on, you know, typically executables in a lot of ways, right? When you look for like where weird executables that are running, and I know that's, there's like other ways to run things, but that was like how I grouped things by, and they heavily use DLLs. And so they end up using run DLL32 a lot to load their DLLs or find other ways to load DLLs. And I only say that now because I wouldn't be surprised. And I don't know if you've seen it with the current reporting, but you know, we see all the, DLL sideloading attacks, right? There is no reason why this group, based on known executables where they wouldn't leverage the hell out of that based on their development previous years. So there's that aspect, right? So a lot of the things they were loading in were DLLs in different ways and fashions and stuff. And even their custom malware was, their downloaders were basically loading in their DLLs for that purpose. But there's some unique things that I saw. One, in some of their malware, they were using CMD to basically run all their stuff. So any kind of execution beyond the malware, it was leveraging CMD. So when you look at that parent-child relationship, obviously weird parents to CMD. Can stand out. They did kind of inject into a lot of known processes and stuff, so that might be harder to see. But obviously, multiple executions within time windows, if there's a lot of activity, could be questionable. But one of the things I had learned about, and it was weird because it's just like a Windows thing, right? Was getting run DLL32 to run JavaScript. And it's such an indirect, like I should have counted the number of steps. Of them here, but basically, see, there's 5, 9, 13, 15 steps where Windows fails, but then has all these like catches to try to get to where it actually will execute the JavaScript. But basically, the example you kind of see here is basically it's trying to do this JavaScript, and it's going to do the MS HTML. With the export run HTML application and anything that follows, it'll end up executing. But it basically, you know, tries to parse the command and it decides the intended DLL is the JavaScript, you know, MSHTML. It fails to load it. Then it goes, tries to find a working directory or path, fails to manifest the module. Then it calls load library, and in load library, it adds the extension and it attempts to load JavaScript as the MS. So like, one of the things that fails because there's no extension is that actually purposely puts .dll on there. And then it treats it as a relative. So then it searches for that DLL, which it does find in the system directory. So it like tricks, and in its ways of failing, it finds the correct DLL to run that wasn't specifically stated, right? And then it's able to load that actual entry point. And then it attempts to execute the command, but it's invalid. When it calls the git command, then it attempts to open the URI. So ask the system basically how to handle JavaScript protocol, which is typically set to Microsoft HTML JavaScript pluggable protocol in the registry. So then it executes the JavaScript, and then the first statement that gets executed. So, you know, it's like, you know, Windows develops itself to essentially not throw a bunch of errors and make the user experience, you know, really good and, you know, things don't break. And because of their way of building that way, that's why this works. And it's like kind of a counterintuitive way that they've figured out. And not only that, this was something they actually stole from some other person who developed malware from. So that was something else that was interesting about this group was a lot of the capabilities they had built into their malware. Were either seen in other malware that seemed to be really creative or successful, but they're constantly like pulling and porting things in or even modifying off the shelf malware they find and using that as well. So that was a really, really cool technique to see. And then the other thing was it's some of their malware, like I said, a lot of their modules are other pieces of malware because they typically load like a suite of malware when they hit a target, at least early on, right? It wasn't just one malware. It was like different malwares for different purposes. And so one of the things they leveraged was one malware run DLL32 because the other malware was a DLL. And you can see the variable percent s there. That was just its way of calling in its own code, but it used the ordinal number. So I've talked about this before. This usually stands out a lot to me in general from groups because you have your entry point. Usually you're used to the DLL and then what function or entry point you want to call when you run DLL32. But the ordinal number is basically if you were to export all those entry points, like what number does it get? Like they get sequential numbers essentially. So it's saying call the first entry point, which if you're really lazy or just maybe it's the typical way when you build a DLL, your entry point might be the first thing anyways. So looking for the ordinal number pound one with run DLL is like a big sign that it's typically not something that is a standard software program running when that happens. So another case, right, run DLL. And then the other thing was some of the execution when they did some COM object hijacking. So I've talked about COM object hijacking before on the podcast. The big thing with this one is this is using the MM device enumerator, which basically is associated with anything that needs to use audio. It's like the class that helps connect audio drivers or audio in general to different applications. So that's kind of how COM objects are used in Windows, right? They're like kind of like helpers to basically extend functionality from applications so it can leverage other applications or processes or things. And so a lot of the times what you'll see in a COM object that's defined in Windows is you see that standard registered key, like the computer, it's the system or current user software classes, and there's some CLS ID, and that CLS ID is usually pretty unique to that specific COM object. But in the nproc server 32 registry, that is where you put like a path to something that will load when that COM object is hit, essentially. So in this case, they put their malicious DLL in there. So when anything in the application wants to touch or potentially use audio, it would load their stuff. That was like a way, kind of, we could say execution, but we also say persistence. A lot of these behaviors do kind of overlap. So kind of a really cool approach, right? To leverage something that a lot of people don't typically look at. And, I think it can be, really highly effective. So.
Yeah, tying in the like newer activity when you mentioned the DLL and kind of the DLL side loading, like that even within the last 6 months has been, the continued focus from this specific adversary, leveraging in this specific case, trying to not give too much away, the leveraging, applications in the Microsoft Office suite to side load from there, but they would actually leverage the process and they would actually pull a DLL from a kind of a non-standard spot. So in the general program data folder or like a program data temp, so for kind of a non-standard to pop that DLL in, which is interesting because it kind of leaves you breadcrumbs for telemetry to kind of track that because that is absolutely not traditional operations from the Microsoft Office suite of tools. But
Yeah,
yeah,
like
and
I.
then go ahead.
Well, I was just gonna. The one thing I was gonna insert that I didn't comment on is the cool thing about the COM object hijacking is the nproc server 32. Any of those values in registry, I don't think are commonly changed. They're kind of like set because they're pointing to an executable or a DLL or something. So just paying attention to those specifically, and if those change, it's worth noting what they point to. Like it doesn't necessarily mean it's always bad, but if it points to something that you don't know or seems weird, especially in the location, it's a huge red flag.
Yeah, and at minimum, it should be low volume, right? So if you're looking at
Yeah, I
like
would
from the
think so.
telemetry side, you should be able to decipher that. The what's interesting too is we hit execution. We're kind of starting to talk on it. This adversary is heavy into low bins, like heavy, 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 heavy. So it's kind of cool that we got to kick off on a few of that. That's going to be a trend, I think, going to the next few slides, Scott.
All right, you ready to jump forward?
Let's do it.
All right. Persistence. I'll let you take the round on this one.
Okay. Yeah, this is another one where I think it's this is where even though it's a nation state adversary, and Scott, we had this kind of side conversation as we were kind of going through research. You see a lot of sophistication, a lot of heavy, clearly backed with heavy resources, a lot of very in-depth targeting, a lot of leveraging of newer vulnerabilities, leveraging or identifying 0 days for the first time, and a lot of sophistication that goes into that. But in here, we kind of run into more of behaviors that are reused, that are tried and true over time, that are behaviors that we tend to hearken on. They do a lot of the basic persistent measures in most of their cases, almost always actually, and across the years, modification of that run registered key. This is something that is another one of those kind of like this should be a mainstay in your environment to track for those things. The dropping files create or files created in that startup folder. You should this should be also should be a low telemetry thing, right? This should be a rarity that you tend to see that. One that is a little more obscure, not something we tend to see as much, but that modification of that user init MPR logon script registry key to be able to run those initialization scripts at startup. And then the other side is, and again, it's hard. I'm sorry if I'm speaking to this in vague terms, but I'm trying not to directly give it away because we got a little more show left. But that they have, especially in the recent times, they have really put an emphasis on maintaining persistence by gaining foothold in those edge devices. So being able to set foot up in those edge devices, get away from that typical OS cases, like when you're looking at your typical systems, things we talk about all the time with the lull bins and such. They have been getting increasingly aggressive and also very sophisticated at landing in these edge devices so they can just pivot right back in your environment when you clean them out. So just a couple things to note from the persistence side, some that are a little newer, some that are tried and true, but all still valid for this adversary even to today.
Yeah, no. Very well said there. The level of like persistence, I think persistence is a big thing when you talk about APTs or the nation state style actor, because that to me is like their biggest bread and butter, because if they have persistence somewhere, it's usually not just one mechanism, a lot of times, right? They're looking at how can they get multiple hooks in different ways. And the hooks sometimes might be like, well, some of the persistence pieces I'm going to talk through is, and they, some people, you can make the argument for lateral movement as well, but just being able to proxy through something. So you're almost like able to open up access to a network because you've set up these like proxy points on the edge. Which kind of gives you added persistence to kind of, redirect or get inside. So points of persistence here, that I thought were pretty interesting. One, looking, back historically, that user init, MPR logon script, that's, commonly used going back to, the 2015, 2016 timeframe, right? So it's interesting that that is a common mechanism. Obviously, that's only going to get triggered when a user logs in. It might not have the same privileges or something that they may want. Obviously, scheduled tasks, that's a big thing they were using as well. The big thing to really take note there, some of the scheduled tasks they're using were running things like .bat files and stuff. So if you have visibility to schedule tasks, look for, it not just being purely an executable. If it's a script file, that's usually pretty questionable. One of the really interesting things, they did end up deploying, gosh, I'm trying to remember the date on this one. I don't know if it's specifically in my notes, but a rootkit, right? So you don't really hear about rootkits much anymore. And just because they're, I would say, a little harder to develop or take more time, to develop. But what was interesting about the rootkit itself was there was like three components. It dropped a .sys file, so I would always pay attention to .sys files. Those .sys files are created on system. They're supposed to be really privileged based on how they're used, so you should at least know about them. Then they had a .dll file, which was I think one of the malwares that loads, and then a registry that basically would point to the .dll. But you can only see this stuff when it initially lands, because once a system gets rerun, it basically injects into the early boot phases of the OS, and then it has hooks. So if you were to try to even pull up, does that file exist? Does that registry or that DLL exist? It masks it, so the system will never return those values. So it looks like those files don't even exist, even though they do. And that's kind of the point of a rootkit, right? Is you kind of get ahead of every single thing in the system so that you can take advantage of preventing the system from basically identifying you or kicking you out. So really powerful technique there. And then one of the things they also do is with their rootkit, they were injecting into explorer.exe, which is a common place to inject, but it's also a smart place because if you were to do kind of process chaining, like I kind of talk about from time to time, explorer.exe is the user experience. So anything explorer.exe launches, typically it's a user opening something. So then if you were to look at what executes from explorer.exe that is not typical of either the type of user or just user type behavior in general, that kind of could be a key indicator from a behavior perspective. So that's that piece. The interesting registry key, which is the last one listed there, which was it's the local machine, software, Microsoft Windows NT current version, WinLogon shell. This is what loads Explorer on launch. And so the value of shell is explorer.exe. This registry is also what you would control if you wanted to, say, turn a Windows system into a kiosk or into some other function, because you can have whatever when the OS launches, what application do you want it to launch? That's what it launches on get-go. Now, you can't necessarily have multiple applications listed, so it'd be pretty obvious if you use this for persistence by replacing your malware there, because then Windows itself from the user experience would look like it didn't load and it would just be running the malware. But what you can put in there is .cmd or bat file scripts. So you can have it launch Explorer and other things because you have a bat file or a script there that the Windows will then run. And so that's the key thing to look for there, is they have leveraged that. And the important thing with leveraging that is you get system level privileges because it's running a local machine. You have to have a lot of privileges to be able to set that. But that's something to pay attention to, which is interesting. But going pivoting to the first few things I was talking about with the BM and a proxy through infrastructure, they had a malware that would drop. It was weird. They referred to it as a Trojanized SSH. It wasn't really Trojanized. It was just basically using SSH, getting it running on specific edge devices so that they could set up that reverse tunnel. So that means they dropped their own RSA key there, so then they can connect via their RSA key, and they basically set it up. And the way that command works is they'll come in basically and hit whatever edge device they've compromised with this malware. They will bounce off a port, and then indirectly, that device will then send out off that port to wherever it's supposed to go based on that reverse. So you can kind of create that pivot point seamlessly through that device, just hitting off the right port. And the same thing they did with another compromise and an edge device was using IP tables. If you're not familiar with IP tables, it's basically a firewall for Linux. And why that's significant? Well, a lot of your edge devices or appliances are often running on a Linux, Unix implementation. And so they likely have IP tables already there. So if they're able to exploit something to take advantage of something, this is an IP table rule that basically, so IP tables, like some firewalls, they can kind of group their rules by things. And the pre-routing group is essentially the, hey, do all this before you do anything else. So it gets kind of first on the stack, and it says anything is basically hitting that address for that stuff to whatever dedicated infrastructure internally there is. So you can kind of pivot through a device that way as well, either to connect to, you know, where you have malware installed internally or whatever your means are. So it's kind of a tricky way to have an easy way to just bounce right through any kind of infrastructure that's set up as, you know, we're used to that fortifying wall, the edge, just easily bounce through it when you're able to get that kind of that compromise. So anything else you want to add? Any questions you got there, Tom?
No, you know, really just a thought. Live thought is kind of that rootkit side. I wonder how are people potentially leveraging protection against that? Because this, I'm pairing up what I had said earlier about it seems like, you know, groups like this are flying under that headline radar, right? Mm-hmm. But these are the kinds of groups that are going to leverage that sophistication to accomplish these rootkits in ways like our. So it made me wonder, like, how often are people considering those things, like, you know, potentially firmware patching, BIOS settings, things like that, that can help kind of mitigate or control these things? Are they actively considering that in their environment? Is it, you know, what are the resources kind of going to that? But that's just kind of a loose thought I had, because they've shown that they put effort into that development, and I imagine that will continue because it is a good way to get a very deep, sophisticated foothold, right? So that's just the one quick thought I had off of what you were talking about.
All right, well, let's pivot forward then. We'll go to defense evasion.
Defense evasion.
All right, I'll pick up on this one first. So there were some interesting things. Obviously, they're a group that really doesn't like to be detected, and persistence is a big thing. And a lot of that really shows, because I was looking earlier on as how they prevent their malware from being detected. Obviously, earlier days, 2008, 2009, we relied heavily on IOCs. And heuristics was a thing, but not like it is today. Some of the techniques I may mention are really interesting and may not apply, but still could. But specifically, one of the things I stumbled across, and I didn't know about it, and I don't honestly know what tool sets, you know, EDRs or things even pick up on this. So as I talked to this, if anyone knows that they know there's telemetry for this, I would love to know, because I didn't take time to dig too deep into that, but it's called mail slot. So I'm sure people are probably familiar, if they've ever dug into interesting artifacts, on like pipes or named pipes. And it's basically inter-process communication, IPC calls, to allow basically process to communicate. And pipes are bidirectional, right? So you can kind of go both ways, essentially. And mail slot is something that still exists in Windows today, from what I can confirm. And it's unidirectional. So you're able to write to, but you're not able to like pull back or read back. And it looks similar to any kind of kernel device, like a pipe would, you know, the way the backslashes mail slot, and then you can name it whatever you want. And this was actually leveraged, like I mentioned before, they sometimes develop multiple malware on a system and even in the environment. And from the analysis, it was believed this is how they were able to centrally get all the information they were collecting to the right malware process that was responsible for the C2 or exfilling of data, to constantly keep that data flowing that way, consistently, and, you know, collecting essentially and centralizing. And you can create a bidirectional communication with mail slot. You just end up creating two of them, right? One for one direction of things and the other for the other. But I've never seen that before. So I kind of learned something digging into this that I thought was really interesting and theoretically could still be applicable. So, like I said, I don't know what, things pull this type of telemetry. But obviously if it does, and if things are even using it, because it might even be archaic enough where it's not a common thing that people leverage these days. If anyone tried to use it, it might just come off as they're being malicious. So there's that. Masquerading, man, this group really understands the naming conventions of the Windows operating systems and even Linux. Like, that's the one thing that if you looked at all the samples and everything, it is almost, they don't seem like the single character naming file convention like I'm used to calling out, where, oh, they're lazy and do whatever. They spend a lot of time blending their stuff in. So I would say, one, be familiar with what are just native to a system, but also be familiar with, if it looks and sounds legitimate, does it exist in a legitimate spot? You know, a lot of times we talk about OS specific locations when it comes to like System 32, SysWow 64, or, you know, even just your program files. You know, typically installs will go to program files and they're kind of quasi protected, so a lot of things don't write there. So if you see something that seems like Windows specific and it's in a download folder or in some temp folder or whatever, temp might be, you might run into some false positives that way, because I think Windows uses temp heavily for like updates and things. But my point being is, you kind of have to be familiar enough with the OS and then look for really the location-based stuff. That helps really pull a lot of that out. And then one of the other interesting things that they've leveraged early on, and this is really early, and I thought it was a really interesting technique, because we've seen where delaying execution is a great way to avoid sandbox analysis, right? But even sometimes AV tools. One of the techniques they actually leveraged for some of their malware was, they would actually set a small buffer and they'd set a value, so many bytes into this buffer. I think the value is, say, 42. Then they would do, they create a temporary file and do 1 million writes and then 1 million reads. And that was just a delay tactic, right? Just to basically eat up time on the CPU delay. And then after it was done doing all that, it would look back at that small buffer to see if that value was in the right byte place and it was still the same. Because, and I feel like this was more earlier AV or EDR type tooling, you know, what your EDR does to actually gain an advantage when things execute is, they hook all your processes, right? And then they're able to do some analysis on the fly as things are running. Well, if said, if it hooked this process and say it accidentally did not hook it correctly, or in a way where it tampered that buffer was like a canary, where it would say something tried to hook me and it messed this up in a way where now I know that something's up and I'm basically either going to be caught if I go further or whatever. So it was a really cool anti-analysis technique, kind of at a code level. The only thing here was, obviously, no one really tracks read and writes. That'd be really verbose, especially for millions. But they did create like a temp file and things in temp directories for this kind of stuff. So, like I said, pay attention to weird directories in a lot of cases. But those are some interesting things I kind of pulled out from a defense evasion.
Yeah, Scott, I think, I don't know if anyone in the chat can confirm. Haven't Google searched anything yet, but I think mail slot is, I think it's like the, I don't think it's enabled by default, and or it's being aged out, because I think there was, if I remember right, I think there was something with it, because it's just inherently insecure. Like, it's just natural
Yeah,
type.
my
So
quick research was like, you can use it if you want, but I didn't go into like how to use it. So, yeah.
yeah. No, but it's interesting at the point in time, because again, this adversary has been around for quite a bit, right? So great demonstration. My side, I have one that does kind of bleed over into certain things, but I applied it to the defense evasion here, just from the, you know, kind of the notion of how it's accomplishing what it's trying to. So I think it's like multifold approach, which is a cool technique, considering that it can play multiple fingers into a given compromise. But we're talking about disabling or modifying the system firewall. So leveraging this group has routinely through time, and even very recently, they leverage that, the NetSH, to you know, designate or manipulate the firewall settings to kind of open up a path for themselves, as well as like setting, you know, kind of a port proxy add, or setting up some proxying capabilities within the OS. What's interesting from that, and why I consider it for defense evasion, because I think that their methodology of allowing that kind of communication outbound in that way, I think they do it in a way that makes it subtle enough that I think most places aren't necessarily going to pick up on that traffic once it's accomplished, right? So it kind of lets it blend in, it reduces that detectability, you know, really not giving you a clear identifier of that C2 when they do that in a lot of cases. Additionally, that kind of proxying approach is also leveraged on those edge devices that we mentioned before. That's something that's part of the common process once they gain a foothold on those edge devices. So, you know, just another way to kind of, you know, put themselves in a place where they can blend in. Some of the other stuff too, again, this is the super low hanging fruit. You know, they're actively when things that fall in the defense evasion category. So your obfuscation of your commands within your scripting and your PowerShell commands, and your loaders, the encryption methods they're using, the file masquerading, which is something you've already discussed. Those are tried and true stuff that is being leveraged and has been leveraged over their whole timeline, which has been interesting to watch. Like, they have these basic things that are constantly leveraged. So yeah, you know, again, harking on the same thing, but that's just a couple things I had from the defense evasion side. But the system firewall modification, though, I do think bleeds over into our next one. It's got to want to go forward.
Yeah, and the one thing I wanted to call out too, like I talked about masquerading, and even if you look at like the firewall, the rule name, you know, remote event log management SMB, like it sounds legitimate. One of the, when you see something that looks legitimate, the best way to like confirm that is look to see, do adjacent devices have the same file or have the same rule sets? Because it'd be really weird in an environment that's managed to not have that consistency. So that's a great way to maybe trigger around things, and then how you would investigate it to quickly come up with a, you know, confident answer there.
Yeah.
All right. Lateral movement. Yeah. Not much changed.
No, not much changed. It's pretty similar. Yeah. So, you know, when you're talking about that same system modification, so the same approach with opening up those firewall or that proxying approach, it really kind of gives them the ability to route that traffic from their C2 through devices once they've made that foothold, allowing that additional depth of lateral movement. You know, other things too, I think too, Scott, like talking to lateral movement, I know you have some depth on your side, but there's also that use of those common MOBINs, the stuff that's native, right? So the leverage of WMI, leverage of PSExec, these are things that this group has tried and true over time, generally went to just to kind of keep that general profile of blending in with system activities, trying to be discreet, leveraging what's there, not dropping much that's net new, you know, evading those detections. So,
and they're really good at identifying privileged users. You know, we talked about the with the
profiling.
Yeah, like they're able to like do the research on the company, figure out who their intended like people targets are pretty quickly, and go at them in different ways. So when it comes to lateral movement, you know, once they are able to gain access and target the people appropriately, that's usually if they're going to do any kind of lulbin stuff, they're using those privileged accounts like you would see any privileged account moving on a network essentially. So,
yeah. But,
all right. Credential access. All right, I'll you know, harp on this. NTLM, that's like, this is the one technique. They have figured out so many creative ways to basically get an environment or users to send NTLM hashes, you know, normal or V2 or whatever, to collect. And so, you know, we've talked about this offline. They have to have that capability. One, they're a nation state, so they're, you know, well-funded, right? They have supplies. There's no reason why they couldn't just have a basic data store that is a rainbow table. And if you're not familiar with what a rainbow table is, it's like already pre-computed passwords that are hashed in whatever way you're trying to break. So it becomes a lookup table. So you're like, oh, I've got this hash. What does it match? It matches this password. So pre-computed. And so I imagine they have this because they've leveraged this capability going back to like the early 2010s to like present day almost. And if you're going to keep leveraging that technique, you have to have that capability. The thing is that I love about this is they've used vulnerabilities to discover this. They've used ways you interact with websites. They've used it in phishing files. I've seen where they basically, when you pull down a Word document, you can have a template established, and there's a path that you can put for what template to pull down for the content, and you can put an SMB path, which basically would pull a template from a remote place. But if it's SMB, you're going to do this type of exchange where you're passing a hash to, so you're allowed to have it essentially. Well, they've leveraged this in so many ways. any SMB callouts on the network external to your environment is highly questionable and should be looked at that way until you understand what's going on. So that's why I called that one out extensively. That's a technique I would be looking for over and over again, especially with this group, because they seem to do the best with this, getting really creative. But historically, obviously, if you go really far back, Mimikatz was very prominent, so that was easily leveraged. And then also password dump. It was a very common technique, and it still gets leveraged from time to time. But Run DLL, like I mentioned before, they seem to love Run DLL, but they're using a system DLL, which is the COM server S or service, whatever how you want to say that, and it's a elongated form, but it has a mini dump function in it, and you can pass a process ID, and basically if you pass it LSAS, which is the process that manages the internal credentials and authorization of things, they can dump that, and then you can try to extract creds out of that. Now there's a lot of protections in modern systems now with like Credential Guard and other things that maybe interfere with some of this, but this is a common technique they used. And I have seen this tried to be leveraged in more recent things, not necessarily tied to this adversary, but it's a known technique essentially. But yeah, Intel HIM is where I would put my money on as far as, especially with the initial stuff, like right? All the initial credential stuff, that is a prominent thing. What do you got?
Yeah, on my side, it's is something that is again another tried and true technique that's leveraged. So I have a theme on my side, but that's okay because these are things that are still being leveraged. And
Right.
with the focus from the adversary to really kind of have that high profile, high targeted attacks to gain the right access, the right credentials to do all the right things. This is one that becomes easy once you kind of have that foothold, right? So creating a volume shadow copy is something that is prominent, has been seen time and time again from this adversary. And then, typically in more recent campaigns from theirs that were identified, they're grabbing that shadow copy, creating that shadow copy, and then copying out the ntds.bit file, as well as the system registry hive. And then they would pull those down, grab those out, and do the thing. But this is one that's relatively easy to detect and hunt on. And it is commonly leveraged by them, but it is also one that the telemetry should be there in pretty common form, not something you really have to go above and beyond to put in place. I imagine most tools are kind of looking out for some of this as well. But yeah, it's really one of the ones that I had for this. It's a simple low pro one, but it's effective. This is one that's easy to track for.
Yeah. All
All
right.
right. What we had next?
Next, we have the weird one, Impact. And I say weird because it's nation state, right? Like, there's probably a lot of impacts we don't know. Because, like I said, when you think of a nation state, sometimes information is key. So it's how do we make good decisions or competitive decisions or impactful decisions? It's more about driving decision making in a lot of ways. And the more information you have to help with those decisions, the better. And then obviously, if you can kind of impede something, that can be beneficial. But usually, when you start to impede things, you kind of give away and give tells that you're there. So I think that's why a lot of nation states don't do a lot of that. But like I said, geopolitical things kind of drive a lot of that. So one of the really interesting impacts, and we talk about knowledge is power. There was a pretty interesting campaign, and I believe it hit a foreign government. And they were able to essentially identify who was the administrator for their DNS. And they then changed the MX record of the DNS. An MX record is what you use to point to your webmail. So if your webmail kind of exists in different infrastructure and that kind of thing. So when someone looks or you send an email from your domain or someone wants to send an email to you, that's how they find out where to send it via an IP. And they changed the MX record to a basically webmail proxy of the adversary side. So one of the things to know about webmail is it naturally isn't necessarily secure. So they were able to basically reroute the mail to its intended location because they could do that, but they're able to see everything being sent via webmail, which is crazy. Like the amount of information you get from just basically saying, "Oh, I can read everybody's emails, in real time on the fly," is pretty powerful. So when we talk about like what is your motivation there, it's very clear. Like that was a great compromise by them. It's something very people few people will even look at, and the only way people would even complain is if there was some sort of throughput issue, right? Because if everything, as long as they make sure everything's working, there's no reason to even look to see if there's a problem. So that was really interesting. And then the other thing that we talk about data theft or just collecting information in general. One of the things that they seem to collect pretty heavily, and it's they seem to have really good knowledge of the Windows operating system. So they basically would scrape off all the registry hives using a bat file, and they would save all the hives out, and then they would use PowerShell to compress the hives. And I don't know how many people use PowerShell to compress things, and this actually was more recent as I was working my way up through the timeline. So this might actually overlap with more present things. But most people use, like WinZip, WinRAR, which they use heavily. They use WinRAR heavily. And sometimes they even use WinRAR and it's not even named WinRAR. But it's like their go-to tool because usually when you operate in that region of the world, WinRAR is way more popular. But the compress archive, I think it's always good to pay attention to when PowerShell is doing this because if someone's using compress archive in PowerShell and it's legitimate, it's probably built into a process and it's easily to exclude or explain away versus when you just see something from the command line running compress archive, it's worth knowing what that is because one, this group uses this to pull together all their things, and two, I think it's shouldn't create that much noise and it's worth looking at. But yeah, all their stuff is really about really staying persistent. That's why we say like to talk impact, there's really cool ways to essentially show where they've been successful. But I feel like a lot of their success really is delivered through how long they stay somewhere or how long they're or more things are able to compromise, like the breadth of that too. So yeah, what's your overall take here?
Yeah, and a lot of the techniques we've talked about too, they are always kind of multidimensional, right? So there's
Yeah, they are.
multiple levels of use there. So we've categorized them just to kind of keep a track here as we work through our, discussing them. But they do tend to have, tentacles that spawn into efforts for something else. But on my side, one of the ones that I thought stood out and I grabbed was leveraging that built-in Windows utility cipher.exe. Those who don't know or might not be aware of it, it's a command line utility that allows encryption, decryption of files and folders, and it also lets you securely wipe stuff to securely delete things. But it is built in; it's native to Windows. So they have in campaigns leveraged that to act as like a cleanup, so to kind of hell that stealthiness, to kind of apply that ability to stay under the radar. They'll drop whatever scripts files that they are bringing in. They'll grab the data that they're grabbing, like what we talked about with like the shadow copies, the NCDS.bit files, and grabbing the registry hives, things like that. They'll compact everything they have, prepare everything to ship, and then they'll leverage Cypher to then clean it all up. So it removes traces of it and leverages a built-in command line tool that would generally fly under the radar for detections. But this also makes this, in my opinion, pretty high fidelity marker for behavior because you should I'm sure there's environments and administration tactics that leverage this command line utility, but by and large, I would imagine this would be super rare to see. And leveraging this utility is very purposeful. So when you're thinking from your analyst point of view or what you're watching for your environment or what you're looking to hunt for, this one should be very close to true positive when you identify it in my mind, because it just shouldn't happen very often. And when it does, it should have a very straightforward designated use case. But This also, though, as it does apply to Impact, it does have that kind of tentacle of a bit of that defense evasion, a bit of that, trying to hide and masquerade itself, like we keep talking about. But yeah, this one's interesting to me because I just think it's not necessarily thought about a lot, but it is high fidelity when you do see it, and in my opinion.
Yeah, and when we talk about nation states, that they're doing things to wipe and disrupt like that, you got to think about the motives there. Like usually it's associated with conflict or war, right? Because it's more about how do you impact a target for a specific purpose. We think about
I know
that.
as we're getting closer to the show, I'll be a little bit more on exactly what you're saying. Like we're trying to keep ones to kind of, keep the show intact for the game, but the destructive side is also very prominent from this group, right? So especially when they might pertain to, conflicts or their what they're trying to accomplish as a nation state backed group. The destructiveness is all over the place. So not just masquerading and trying to stay in a foothold, but there are also many definitions of this group going in and just making sure that they eliminate the capability of the other side to do anything or cover as fast as possible. So that's also part where we didn't necessarily go into some of those details for Impact to give it totally away, but definitely a thing.
Yeah. All right. So before we get into the guessing, block to give you some time to stew, let's go over some malware. I'll let you kind of run with this a little bit, and I got some interesting notes to kind of add, but we got just a few minutes to really dig into this before we got to give some time for the countdown.
Yeah, so I'll try to stay high level, Scott,
Yeah.
because there's a lot here, and I know we had this as like an extra in case we had, kind of that filler side. But the effort and the ability of this group to leverage custom malware families, deploy custom malware families, and then hold them over time has been really interesting to read about. So I don't know how it was for you when you researched this, but when I seen all of the variant malware families, some that I knew about, some I hadn't heard about before, honestly, they slipped past my radar, including some that are relatively newer. But some of the stuff that they're leveraging to accomplish so many things, but the points, because I'm cautious on giving it away because of the time, but newer ones that are, malware families that are written in many different languages, right? So C++, Go, all kinds of variations, and some that have existed and have been adapted for over a decade that are still being leveraged today. Others that were very specific, very targeted to very specific systems that were leveraged. And they were throwaway. So we'd never seen them, never heard about them again, didn't even really see any adaptations of them because they were so targeted a very specific zero day or a very specific targets environment. I can't put enough emphasis on the extremes that this adversary does go to generate these kinds of tools. So while they do have a lot of that masquerading, a lot of leveraging the lol bins, there are many sophisticated malware families that they have leveraged over time and still continue to leverage. I'm hesitant to give anything away, Scott. I'm watching the time, but I'll let you take a couple minutes here while I dig to see what I can pull out without just saying the answer.
Yeah, I'll throw in some other nuggets here. So some interesting things that they've communicated with their malware is they've used SMTP historically for the older malware side of things. But like we talked about, some of the malware that they leveraged, either they develop in a very modular fashion or they're really good at just like kind of adding to. But you can see the evolution of some of their malware. And there's even one version of their malware which is really fascinating was they built in a capability to where, even as it kind of propagates, and when it lands on a system, it tries to basically move data to basically routing messages between local directories, the registry, and USB drives. So it has this consistent way to collect data or put data in those three different places. And the reason why they believe this was the case was to attack air gap networks, right? Knowing there's some form of sneaker net. So all you got to do is basically say every time something touches the system that they can control, how do you collect or gather information and move it? Which is kind of a interesting approach. And then the other thing that they leverage is the local add data environment variable directory to drop a lot of their stuff to run. And they'd run it as basically masquerading real processes and things. So, that's when we talked about locations, a big deal. And then last little nugget, compile times. They looked at compile times with all the malware, and that was like the most telling, because the compile times were the normal business hours in UTC for Moscow or St. Petersburg. So, as a kind of a big hint of maybe what nation it may be affiliated with, something to think about.
Yeah, a couple of the newer, like very recent ones. You have malware families that are set to kind of give that foothold, leverage persistence in multiple fashions. So it'll go after the comm hijacking, the registry run, auto run modifications, the DLL side loading. It'll take a multi-prong approach. Also, it'll leverage its C2 to kind of point out at common cloud services to try to do that blending and masquerading. Another one, a more recent one as well. This one is interesting because it goes to the kind of lie in wait and collect data. It seems that this malware family is really designed to just bring in and capture data, right? So one of the key parts of this malware family is to capture screenshots, leveraging the native Windows API functionality. So it kind of just stays low and bro. And they have, kind of a dynamic, named functionality to throw it as like a desktop dot whatever to try to blend into whatever the system is. But yeah, just a couple newer ones that are like within the last couple months that were pointed out.
Absolutely. All right. So the guess who time, right? Here's kind of the recaps of the rules. One guess. There's a submission link. First 10 to get it right, they have a chance to win a t-shirt there. And once we announce it, that's when we call it there. Let's see if I can even throw this up there. Got a timer. Maybe I can share it properly. Share. Share something else. All right. I'm gonna put this at 2:30.
Yeah. Give us time to say goodbye. Flash your slide really quick.
On to 2:15. All right, so yeah, here's the countdown. Think about some of the things we said. I mean, obviously, we've talked about some key things that we pulled from reporting. So a lot of the techniques I probably would use. Is if there's anything you can recall, I mean, Google is your friend, right? But if you can put the right keywords together, you might find the right report. Might find similar things that we were looking at. That would help out a lot, but yeah, hopefully not only is this just kind of a fun way to talk about a threat actor and get you kind of thinking who it might be, maybe do some parallel research, but hopefully we left some good nuggets there, right? To help maybe think about this threat actor in the future, think about some of the things that maybe you're not looking for from a threat hunting perspective or a threat detection perspective. And also, I would like to, for this last minute, I really think the exercise that Tom and I went down, like we were talking offline about this, it's just really fun to dig into an adversary this way. Not like you're given one report and then you figured out. It's like, hey, I want to just find everything I can and then sift through all that stuff and see what is connective tissue between all the stuff I've collected. And then having another set of eyes doing something similar, and our approach was kind of two ends of the time spectrum. It's kind of cool to compare notes. So I think there's a lot of value in that. So yeah,
Yeah,
time resources and have somebody you like to do that stuff with, that would definitely do it.
I can't recommend that enough. I know we the security industry that we're in, it's constantly moving and we have to react fast, but being able to take a step back, no matter what what your designated role is, doing this kind of deep dive and this stuff you unlock, you think we're in it day to day, right, Scott? But this we look back a little bit, we're like, wait, things we didn't consider,
Oh,
things
yeah, we learn new
we
things
were
just
novel to
constantly.
us, right?
Yeah.
Tab nabbing, man. Tab nabbing.
All right. So getting ready for the big reveal. Go back to share something else. And here goes the alarm. I'm sure you can hear it. It's really obnoxious. All right. That's the adversary, APT 28. Russian state-sponsored cyber espionage group, right? They work closer to GRU. There's a lot of branches in their sec, but GRU's the more advanced technical side of the house. Active since 2007. So we talked about this one goes quite a ways back. Long-term intelligence collection. I think we've definitely hit on that. Credential theft, influence operations. They have a lot of aliases. Fancy Bears, I think, is, and Sophocy are like, I think the ones that we've heard of a lot. Pawn Storm was the tag that was given for a pretty big breach. I think that was some network devices. That might have been the SNMP stuff.
Those that are following the Microsoft side, Force Blizzard. I think before it was like Scrontium or something like that. Strontium.
Yeah. The metals and things.
So,
hopefully this was insightful. Hopefully we had some winners that actively participated. And the biggest win for us is everyone learned something, right? They were able to walk away with understanding maybe an adversary a little bit better, maybe looking at some things that when you break them down, things you can actually do for someone that in most cases would say is very advanced. You can see why they're advanced, but you can also see kind of what the gotchas are. Go ahead.
No, I was just saying, I think just a quick add on to that point, I think that's important to say, because I know that we speak and talk to every level of maturity of cyber defenders and threat hunters and folks out there trying to do this, even because it is a nation state adversary and they're very complex and have a lot of focus, detail and resources. There are still things that are absolutely detectable and huntable from a novice level all the way up through a high maturity. So hopefully folks on all levels were able to pull something from the show.
Yeah, completely agree. And just if you liked what you saw here, some of the other things we do that are a little more hands-on, we have a intel-driven threat hunting workshop, December 3rd. So check that out. If you can, follow anything Intel 47 related, or us on LinkedIn, you should see activity on that to be able to join. And with that, I just really appreciate everybody. Participating and engaging and listening in. And with that, we'll close out with happy hunting.
Happy hunting, everyone.